David Denby is a longtime and highly renowned film critic for The New Yorker, and he's with us today to talk about a new book called Snark. It's mean, it's personal, and it's ruining our conversation. Thanks so much for being with us.
Hi.
So I was delighted to read this book because I think it was around, I feel like it was about 12 to 15 years ago, I first heard the term snarky. And somehow, even though I had never seen it in a dictionary, I felt like I knew what it meant. It's that kind of a word.
It sounds like what it means.
Exactly. Not exactly onomatopoeia, but something like it. So
it was actually made up by Lewis Carroll. After writing Alice in Wonderland and Through the Looking Glass, he wrote a nonsense poem called The Hunting of the Snark. And the snark is a mythical beast, and never quite says what it is, or why everyone wants to kill it so badly. But by degrees, it passed into the current meaning by the beginning of the 20th century, maybe 1905 or something.
And actually, you subtitle your book A Polemic in Seven Fits, so you're kind of mimicking some of the style of the Lewis Carroll long poem, right?
Yes, apparently fit was still in existence in the 19th century as another way of saying stanza or canto. So, and then I thought it was fun to play on fit as a man having a fit. So.
And the hunting of the snark is this voyage of a bunch of strange people, bakers and servants and beavers and typical nonsensical Lewis Carroll kind of stuff.
Right, all beginning with B.
All beginning with B.
Right.
Oh, I really loved in the third fit, you highlight this issue of when you come upon a certain type called, of all things, a boojum.
Yes.
If you say it out loud, it disappears or you disappear.
If you encounter a special kind of snark called a boojum, it can make you disappear. So I thought that it was fun to play with this as a metaphor, that since there are certainly seem to be writers of snark who would like their victims just to go away, to disappear.
Now, in Rumpelstiltskin, what was it that happened when the name was said?
Oh, I forget.
Yeah, I always forget whether it's you disappear when you say his name or he disappears. Mm. But anyway, boojum seemed like such a great word. Maybe we should identify for our listeners what you mean when you're talking about snark.
Say it again?
Identify for the listeners how you would define snark, since that's the topic of your book.
Well, I would say it's personal abuse. It's not hate speech, which is directed at groups, but it's aimed at individuals. It's low, it's mean, it's nasty, it's rug pulling, it's teasing. And it often, in our contemporary media version, relies on making reference to something lying around on the media junk heap, familiar characterization or something. In other words, it's lazy. It doesn't create anything new. I mean, even a fresh physical description, I think it's, you know, no matter how mean, and God knows I've written some as a movie critic, it seems to me, legitimate verbal creation, but the characteristic of snark that I'm thinking of sort of relies on audience recognition because it doesn't create anything new. It just refers to something that's lying around. So, in other words, it's lazy.
And it's not particularly edifying, as in the book you talk about the history of satire.
Yeah, satire is a very elaborate and distinguished form, of course. It goes all the way back to ancient Rome, and it's mockery of current manners or mores or institutions, but it often has a kind of reforming quality. That is, it implies a better world, a finer way of life than what we've got now. So snark is just a lazy phrase. Satire is much more elaborate and formal, a literary form, and that's what I want to protect. And also all the other forms of humor, like spoof and literary burlesque and parody. All of those things are wonderful. And there are people who are sort of on the borderline between snark and satire, like Jon Stewart, who does make fun of people's appearances and so on for an easy laugh. But also, if you listen closely, there's a kind of civic passion behind a lot of his jokes. And Stephen Colbert also. I mean, they you know, during the Bush administration were saying, this is not a way a government should work. So that was, I mean, that was a serious point behind their jokes. So they would go high and low at the same time. A little hard to sort that one out.
Yes. Yeah, and there is a kind of passionate engagement. You know, when you write in the book about the Roman type of attacks at, you know, like feasts and things like that, it's kind of reminded me of the roasts where you see, you know, some comedian get up there and all of his friends say absolutely outrageous things, but at least they know the guy or the woman.
Yeah, well, I think this kind of humor, and we're just making a kind of informal pass here at scholarship, that the Greek drinking clubs, maybe around the time of Homer, you know, maybe 700 or 800 B.C., several years before the greatest period in Athens, aristocrats would gather together and drink, and on one of these occasions, let us say, some wag got the bright idea of taking over the acting in the persona of a low-born Athenian and making fun of someone within the group. So, in other words, it was a kind of licensed invective aimed at someone's personal habits within the group. And then it passed out into the kind of public forum where it was okay to attack your betters, the leaders, and so on, as long as you obeyed certain rules of poetry. So, in other words, this was these attacks, however nasty, were delivered in verse, and they were obeyed certain formal rules. And then in Roman oratory also, there were certain things you could say that we might consider quite vicious about a rival's sexual habits, but you had to do it according to kind of, if you wanted to be taken seriously, that is, formal oratorical modes and so on. That's a long way from what we're talking about today. So, I mean, it's not as if this kind of thing has never been around before. I didn't mean to suggest that at all, and obviously malice is as natural to the human heart as kindness. So it's not an unnatural act. It's just it's become universal. Today, it's just all over the cable news. It's all over the webs, the internet, particularly when people are attacking each other anonymously, It tails off the end of articles that might appear, say, in Newsweek or Washington Post website, where people begin attacking each other. Often it degenerates into race baiting or anti-Semitism or misogyny within, you know, a certain number of exchanges. So the anonymity of the internet has sort of increased the amount of it.
I was very struck by the very thorough depiction of different types of snark that you talk about in your book. For example, there's one section where you imply, I believe, that contemporary snark maintains class barriers. It's almost like keeping out. You say when a dying class of the powerful or would-be powerful struggles to keep the barbarians from entering the hallowed halls.
Well, there's a kind of war going on in journalism because everyone's in a panic. And the mainstream press, the business model doesn't seem to work anymore because they've lost so much advertising in newspapers. I hope the same thing doesn't happen to magazines, but newspapers have lost a lot of their retail advertising and classifieds and so on. So they're angry and upset, and they may be trying to hold on to what they take to be their younger audiences by adopting kind of snippy, snappy, glib tone. And on the other side of the media wall, that is new media, the kids breaking into the internet and not making much money at it, certainly if they want to live in New York or Los Angeles or Washington, D.C. And one way of making a name for yourself is to say something that's allegedly brilliantly funny or nasty about somebody, usually about some established person. So it's, in other words, it's a temptation as a way of making it among younger journalists. And what bothers me about it, I suppose I'm a member of the establishment since I write for The New Yorker and I've been around in my 60s. I wouldn't mind at all attacks that were like some new notion of what art should be or what criticism should be, some sort of avant-garde. But what you get from this kind of attack mainly is someone saying you're not up to date, you're 20 seconds behind the zeitgeist. And they really, a lot of these kids operate as a kind of thugs of the corporations which control most of pop culture and mass culture. So in other words, it's the opposite of an avant-garde. It's more of a commercial enforcer. And so that is what depresses me about it the most.
You write, American life is a viciously competitive race in which every ego has to fight for a limited amount of oxygen. You also talk about snark having to do with our celebrity culture, that there's a kind of phenomenon of create these people and then destroy them.
Oh, yeah. Well, the whole celebrity culture, of course, is snark-ridden from top to bottom, and I don't mean to separate myself from it. I mean, I look at this stuff, too. I mean, partly it's sort of professional need, partially because I write about movies, partially it's just curiosity. But the way we rapidly build people up and want to know everything about them, and then when they slip and they fall in some way, it's like the Furies turn on them and we want to destroy them. And it happens not just in movie and TV and so on, but even sports now. The personal life of sports figures is as much a target of this kind of intrusive snark as anything else. A guy goes to a party and puts his arm around the wrong woman, and
that's
immediately
it
gets on one of these gossipy sports sites with a lot of nasty cracks about it. I don't like this feeling that we're tending towards a kind of everyone is surveilling everyone or surveying everyone else with cell phone cameras. I mean, it's even not just celebrities, but ordinary folks. It's like we're, all watching each other. I mean, that's the sort of anti-utopia that it's moving toward. It could be, you could even make a speech at the local. I was talking to someone last night in Westchester County, New York, who made some statements at a town meeting, and immediately on a local community board there was anonymous, nasty remarks about her speech. What particularly upsets me about it is often is the unsigned.
Yes, anonymous.
I tell my boys, you can say whatever you want, but sign your name to it, cop to it.
Mm-hmm.
Because anonymity gives you the freedom to be completely irresponsible. And, of course, anonymity is a very powerful tool for good. Also, I mean, the whole dissident movements, during the communist period in Eastern Europe and in Russia couldn't have survived without anonymity, or whistleblowers in the government or the corporation who were reporting on corrupt or dishonest practices require anonymity. But when it's just used, to slander someone, and to hide behind a handle, it's pretty nasty stuff. And it can hurt. I mean, it doesn't matter. I don't care what someone says about me at this point, but, I've been at this journalism game for a long time. But people who are just starting out or kids in college, there's a lot of these websites. A guy will, spend a night with a woman and then take her apart, for the entertainment of his friends, very intimately and anonymously on a website. And, if you're 20 and you've gone through a sloshed weekend or something, and all of that might just seem like silly fun or gossip, but, 7 or 8 years later, she might go for a job interview at a corporation or at a hospital, and it will come up on Google.
Yeah, you say that there's a possibility that a lot of this snark is drawing on what you call superfluous anger.
Yeah, what is this? There's this rage that's out there. I mean, this would take a sociologist to sort of work it out. I mean, obviously there's a lot of anger at the moment because of economic inequality and fear of job loss and all the rest. And maybe, that this anonymous ragging at people is one way that it comes out. I mean, we've had a democratic revolution here of a major order. The internet, it's an amazing invention and an amazing event in the history of democracy, that suddenly anyone has the right to, to address hundreds of thousands of people, not just the people who own the press have that right, and their people who work for them like me, but that anyone can do it. I mean, and that's marvelous. And all sorts of generous information is being passed around that's very useful and like that. But at the same time, I think de Tocqueville said, in the wake of a democratic revolution, you also get an explosion of egotism and rage and spitefulness. So that's the bad side.
And maybe do you think we're kind of in our infancy with all this?
I think so. I think it's so exhilarating because it's so new a toy, and that maybe some of this will calm down,
right,
in another 10 years. I mean, another thing I find creepy, and maybe this is I'm on the wrong side of the generation gap now, is that how eager kids are to yield up their privacy, and privacy's a very complicated issue in the internet era. And there are a lot of people very worried about it, legal theorists and so on. I mean, the medical records, credit information, all sorts of, stuff about you is out there, or can be out there and made available to help you or hurt you. But kids voluntarily yielding up their privacy in social networking sites or in blogs or something, and I don't know, talking about love affairs, they're going to get hurt by the use that other people make of this. Because if you confess something has gone wrong in your love life or something, you're not going to get sympathy for the most part. You're going to get a kind of jeering, nasty, snarky tone from people.
It's going to stick to you like Velcro for the rest of your life.
Yeah, then it's there. Yeah, it used to be a few, but, if you screwed up in New England, you packed your bags and went to San Francisco.
Right.
That was how the West was founded. But you can't escape anymore. You can't escape your reputation. It drags electronically, sort of drags along after you.
Wherever you go, there you are.
There you are. Yeah. So,
well, I'm skeptical of these things. I mean, I'm not a curmudgeonly Luddite or anything. I enjoy technology as much as anyone, but I'm a little skeptical of the fervor. I think your word panic is perfect for so many of these descriptions. There's a desperation for the 2 minutes of fame. And also, you said something so intriguing a few minutes ago about journalism that clarified something for me. Some years ago, when I got back into attempting to do some writing myself, I was so intimidated by a certain, let's see, how can I put this? Multi-adjectival, run-on stuff. I mean, it just seemed like everyone suddenly knew everything and could refer to everything and packed their sentences with jumbo metaphors. And I couldn't tell whether this was good writing or bad, but I certainly didn't feel up to it. So it was a little bit intimidating. And I think everyone just kept trying to one-ups each other.
No, it's bad writing. I mean, good writing is generally, simpler and declarative and clear. But there's a lot of writing, particularly cultural writing, the purpose of which is to let everyone know you've seen everything
and you're up to date,
and to send that signal to editors and to readers rather than to actually say anything. And I try to take that stuff out, that over-allusiveness, that packed-in quality that only communicates that I'm up to date, not what my actual response to, say, a movie is. So it's bad, right?
And I'm really relieved to hear you say that.
And there's tons of it.
And then I began to see very, very snarky book reviews. To me, I noticed it first with the book reviews. And I actually have one here. I want to read you the last sentence from a memoir review just the day or so ago in the Times. Chesa Boudin, who's the son of Kathy Boudin, the weather underground person, he wrote a memoir called Gringo, A Coming of Age in Latin America. It's published by Scribner, and he's a young guy. He's 28, and he's sort of had the radical pedigree and all that, so maybe they wanted to go after him. But listen to the last sentence. Chesa Boudin seems like a genial guy with a bright future stretching far ahead of him. If Gringo is any indication, that future should not include committing sentences to paper with the intention of distributing them widely. I mean, ouch.
wise guy prose at his worst.
Yeah.
At its worst, yeah.
Yeah, there it is.
That's really vicious. If someone writes a first book and you say, this is simply not a writer. I mean, it's
Exactly, and to have it be the very end of the review.
Yeah.
I've noticed there's a lot of that, too. Like, they have this, you know, last jab.
Yeah. Yeah, and no, there's plenty of it. God knows, yeah. And movie criticism, it's complicated because if you're writing a review of a long movie, a long review of a big movie like that, that's terrible, like the recent Nicole Kidman, Hugh Jackman movie, Australia.
Mm-hmm.
I think you have an obligation to entertain the reader.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, why go on about it at any length? And in that case, humor and you know, and aggressive humor, particularly since it's a big commercial product, not the first book of a young writer, you know, who's 20 in his 20s, but a big commercial product with hundreds of millions of dollars behind it. I think you have the obligation to entertain the reader, and that can and even, you know, if assuming that you're making your points accurately in relation to the visual experience on screen, I think it's okay to be really rough. I think, in fact, you have to, but it can be really unpleasant in movie criticism. For instance, if you're writing about acting and just make fun of someone's appearance, and there was a critic who's still around in his 80s named John Simon, who was fairly well known.
Oh, yes.
30, 40 years ago, and he used to do this all the time, and sort of grade actresses and actors too in
That's kind of
beauty contest terms. Well, the nose is strangely shaped, and the calves are too thick.
Ugh, God, I shudder just to think of it.
Yeah,
I remember.
If you do that, and don't say, if you describe an actor physically in a negative way, and don't say how he or she transforms her performance. Obviously, Barbara Streisand wasn't a classic beauty, but if you know, if she did something fresh as a performer and used her looks in some way that was good, then and you don't mention that, then I would say that's snark and movie criticism.
Well, it's fascinating that you refer to this angle, because late last night I got into bed with my new New Yorker and read, as I always do, your film reviews, and this time it was The Soloist and State of Play. And I had just freshly reread Snark in order to prepare for today's interview. And I noticed at the end something that I thought was slipping into Snark. Do you know what I'm talking about? Okay, so I hope this is okay that I say this, but I was a little surprised. You say, Russell Crowe's body is shapeless now, his complexion pasty, his hair long and lank. He looks like a dumpling in a wig.
Yeah, well, what's the next couple of sentences?
Okay, well, that's what I was about to go into.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to read them right now, and this is an example, I think, of what you're trying to say, that what happens after your description. You write, but there's enormous life in his eyes and his voice. Crowe has an animal quickness and sensitivity, a threatening way of penetrating what someone is up to, a feeling for weakness in friends as well as opponents.
He's still a great actor, even though he's let his appearance go. So...
Right. So you're saying that if you can cite these things, but not make them the whole focus
right.
of all that you're trying to say?
If I had cut off the description of his performance after the nasty stuff, I think it would have been unfair to him, because he really is still a great actor. Now, and apparently he's also lost weight, by the way, for his next film. But in his last few films, he sort of looked ghastly, and... And I didn't know whether it was intentional, it was for the role, or whether he was it just, you know, undergone some bad period in his life and let himself go physically. I mean, and that can be the end of you as a movie star if that happens. But I was relieved to see he still seems to me as powerful an actor as ever.
Yeah, absolutely. And your writing is so different than, say, another movie piece I read in just a local paper around here in Connecticut that was talking about the sort of slight but entertaining film 17 Again.
Yeah.
And the author said something so gratuitously stupid about, wouldn't you of course you would rather be with the 17-year-old Zac Efron, is that his name?
Yes.
As opposed to the pudgy, haggard Matthew Perry. It's just, and that was it. It's like, come on. But do you find that you, like, when you're writing this description, that you feel any pressure as a contemporary journalist to throw in some things about appearance this way?
No, I mean, it's, you know, it's a sensuous medium, movies, and sensual also. And I mean, and what the way we respond to what people look like, to bodies, to faces, as well as to landscape, to movement, is, you know, we're sitting there in the dark, engulfed by this enormous screen, if assuming we're going to the theaters still, is a big part of the experience. And and there is an erotic element in the, in, you know, and always has been in the appeal of movie actors. And that's why, you know, the someone like who looks like Seth Rogen coming along and Knocked Up and making love to a gorgeous woman, Katherine Heigl, was sort of a shocker.
Yes,
absolutely.
Because
it seemed to violate all the canons of, you know, Cary Grant and Katherine Hepburn. Or even Rock Hudson and Doris Day, you know, of sort of a kind of physical equality between romantic partners. So that's a part of the common response to movies, and I don't think movie critics can leave it out.
That's a good point. Although in your book, you talk at length about someone who talked about Nicole Williamson.
Yeah. Nicole Williamson was a very talented but rather mad English actor. I think he's still alive, who flailed around a lot. And yes, I quoted, at the end of the book, I quoted some examples of what you would have to say are nasty pieces of writing, which I think are nevertheless totally justified and very effective. And I quoted H.L. Mencken on President Harding's speech abilities and Pauline Kael, on the great film critic, on Nicole Williamson, and Stephen Colbert telling off the president to his face at the White House press dinner a few years ago.
I love what you just said a moment ago about the sensuousness of films, and I'm thinking about big sensuous moments that affected my life. I remember a scene in a film called Holy Smoke when Kate Winslet walks across a field naked.
Yeah.
And I shared this moment with some my sisters and my female friends. This was when Kate's body was a little bit fleshier than it is now. And of course there was all that ridiculous brouhaha during the filming of Titanic that she'd gotten fat. She was never fat, let's face it. But she walks across the field completely confident, completely naked, and she has a belly.
Yeah.
And all of us normal-sized women out there, you can't imagine the relief we felt just by that one image.
Right. It was liberating.
It was very liberating.
Yes.
And I wonder if the same's going on for, let's call them sort of rounder geek men who are being portrayed in, you know, 40-year-old virgin and Knocked Up and stuff like that.
Yeah, well, we'll see whether the Seth Rogen phenomenon persists. I think he also is losing weight and wants to get himself in shape as a survival mechanism. But his recent movies have not done so well, so people may be... he may be overexposed, so to speak. People may be tired of him.
Right.
I don't know. You know, I feel very mixed about this. I mean, part of the movie the reason we go to movies is for that kind of physical idealism of someone who looks great. And actors who look great, like Laurence Olivier or Paul Newman, can do so much that an ordinary looking actor can't do. I mean, they can almost play anything, and they can play ugly too, whereas it doesn't work the other way around. So there is an advantage of being great looking if you have talent.
And of course, in terms of celebrity culture, as you point out, we want the idealization, but boy, are we happy when they fail.
Yeah, now that's the sick part, right?
That's
the sick part. That we've sort of invested some of our own self-love into adoration of an athlete or a movie star, a television star, someone. And instead of experiencing that giving of love as a beneficence, we experience it somehow as a loss somehow or as a wound. And it's very provisional. So when this person slips and falls in some way, and the media turns on them, and of course there's this enormous culture, culture is the wrong word of it, this enormous sort of celebrity industry devoted to following these people, and then when that, you know, and then almost when they slip and fall, and I mean, you can pick your own examples, they were almost hounded to death. The Furies suddenly turn on them and almost trip them up and want them to get drunk and doped and crazy and get into fights and fall down. It's a death watch.
Well, do you think there's something proprietary about the way we feel about these people?
We own these people. They belong to us, and therefore we have the right to dispose of them. We've given some of our self-love to them and loved them, and then we feel at a loss in some way as if we've been wounded, so we take it back in revenge. It's an enormous syndrome that everyone, to some degree, is involved in.
Do you think it mimics at all, free associating here, what happens in families when there's sort of the black sheep phenomenon?
That's an interesting idea.
And there's this shame that you feel, like you want to distance yourself from the person.
Yeah, there is something. That's fascinating. There is something to that. It's pretty ugly phenomenon, and then once everyone gets attached to the notion that someone has to be destroyed, they interpret everything they hear about that person negatively. And it even happens, as I say, not just to movie celebrities or rock and roll people, like Amy Winehouse, a very talented English woman. Mm-hmm. I mean, people are just waiting for her to die.
The next rehab, yeah.
Too. I mean, A-Rod is one of the greatest baseball players ever, and people are just feasting, and maybe because he's so highly paid, on every little mistake he makes. And in a way, if he were less sensitive, if he were simply impervious, as many of the older athletes were, he would be better off. It's a strange, sick phenomenon, this pursuit of him.
Do you think, David, that we're as interested in redemption as we are in the fall?
Well, that sometimes is the next phase, is after we've completely destroyed someone, we allow them to redeem themselves. And that's interesting that you mentioned this, because there is opening Friday in New York, and we'll move elsewhere very quickly, an actually extremely interesting documentary about the heavyweight champion Mike Tyson, who completely fell. I mean, went to prison on a rape charge and then bit another fighter's ears, Evander Holyfield, twice in 1997, and was disqualified from the match and lost all his money and so on. And it turns out he's a very complex, interesting, multi-layered guy. And the director, James Toback, has made a very good close-up portrait of him. It's essentially just interviews and fight footage, but it's extremely well edited, and Toback got a lot out of Mike Tyson, and you really understand him.
I'm very eager to see that, because this is a synchronous moment for us, David. I'm very interested in boxing, and the writing I've done is about my experiences boxing. Mike Tyson is an interesting character. In looking at boxing for the piece I researched, I looked at a lot of boxing films, and that's a very interesting genre.
Yeah.
There's been some fantastic stuff in that regard.
Well, my eye is not very well trained, but there were two fights with Holyfield, and in the first one, it looks to me accidental when Holyfield butts him. Holyfield is about a head taller, and opens up a cut over Mike Tyson's eye, and Tyson loses. So then there's 6 or 7 months go by, and there's a rematch, and Holyfield butts him again, and then to my eyes, it looks intentional this time. And at that point, Tyson went nuts.
And is that when the famous ear biting happened?
That's when the famous ear biting happened. Now, I must say that a lot of the indignation and rage of the boxing writers and fans struck me at the time, and even more so now, as a little bit excessive. In other words, boxing, the intention of boxing, after all, is to kill the other guy. That's normally what it is, but it's contained right within all of these rules, the Marcus of Queensbury rules.
Yes.
Don't hit below the belt, retire to your corner when the referee tells you to. There are rounds, it's timing, it's timed, but there's a certain brutality that's not allowed and beyond which the fight can't go. All of that. What Tyson did when biting him, which is inexcusable, I'm not excusing it in any way, was to...
Right, he went too far.
Was to rip the mask of gentility and rule-keeping off the basic savage nature of boxing.
Ooh, nicely phrased.
If you go to these matches, you know, you hear people screaming for blood, including women, I would say.
So true.
So so the excessive indignation...
It's kind of absurd.
...seemed a little hypocritical to me.
It is a little absurd. You know, the movie that was really, in some ways, destructive to boxing was Million Dollar Baby, because so many people thought that that kind of a thing could happen.
Yeah.
You know, Billy Blue Bear, portrayed in the film by the great Lucia Riker, she hits Hillary Swank after Hillary Swank has turned around. And that would never be allowed. I mean, that fighter would be excised from the boxing world immediately.
Really?
Yeah, absolutely. So people think, oh my God, this is horrific, and you can get killed and you can get brain damaged. Now, admittedly, it is a dangerous sport. There's no question. Many sports are dangerous, though. But as good in some ways as Million Dollar Baby was, as entertaining, let's say, it wasn't realistic. But then, have we ever wanted realism from movies?
No, not quite. although it can get absurd. There's another, since we're on fight films, there's another film opening called Fighting with Channing Tatum.
I'm making notes.
A good-looking ex-model, and it's that bare-knuckle boxing, sort of illegal bare-knuckle boxing.
Oh, like Fight Club stuff?
Yeah, in New York, and it's these guys tear each other apart and bang each other down on marble floors and clubs. And everything, and knock over furniture and glass cases and so on. And the next day, I mean, you know, there's just a couple little bruises. I mean, I've looked worse after falling down in the tub. So it's a commercial movie that, you know, actually it has some charm to it. And it's a lot of fun in many ways because it has a kind of New York idiom that's entertaining.
Are you going to be reviewing these?
Yeah.
Oh, that's wonderful.
But it's not, as we would say, realistic.
Right.
It doesn't, the amount of physical damage that these fights do to these guys and, you know, the amount of pain involved is much greater than anything suggested in the movie.
Right. And actually, they redid, not redid, but they put on a documentary on TV, The Thrill in Manila. That was really a retread for me.
Yeah.
You know, some of the documentaries in fighting films are fantastic. Ring of Fire is a personal favorite.
Yeah.
Do you know that one?
Yeah. There are some people who, surprisingly, people have written very well about documentary, including Joyce Carol Oates. Have you ever read her?
Oh, she's
boxing,
that book on boxing is just, you know, sublime. I mean, here's this little bird-like woman who's taken by her father when she's a little girl to the bloodiest of fights.
Yeah.
I mean, my involvement has been with amateur boxing, which is much more protected and you wear headgear and stuff.
Uh-huh.
But Joyce Carol Oates, literate and prolific and genteel. And
yeah, well, but some of her fiction is pretty hair-raising.
Oh, that's true. That's true.
So she has a lively fantasy life.
And then, and then Norman Mailer, of course.
Mailer,
right?
Yeah.
Right. And
he's very, very good writer.
Yeah.
On boxing. And A.J. Liebling, who wrote for The New Yorker in the 30s, 40s, and 50s.
And I think, now, is David Remnick the editor of The New Yorker now, or did I miss a beat?
Yes, that's right.
Okay. Well, he's definitely written about boxing, too.
Yeah, he wrote a book about Muhammad Ali, yeah.
That's right. That's right. Well, I'd love to have you on sometime to talk about fight films, if you'd be interested.
I'm hardly an expert, but...
yeah, but you sound like you are.
Well, it's just this is on my mind, because I've just seen these two films, Fighting and Tyson. I think they're both worth seeing in different ways. And
remind me of James Toback's other films.
Oh, he's been around as a screenwriter and as a director for about 30 years. He made American Gigolo with Richard Gere a long time ago.
Oh, yes.
Cat People with Natasha Kinski.
Mm-hmm.
And
so those
the
are
Pickup
some
Artist with Robert Downey. He worked with Robert Downey when he was young. And he wrote the screenplay of Bugsy, the Warren Beatty film about Bugsy Siegel.
Yeah,
so this is a kind of comeback for him, too, as well as for Tyson.
Well, you know, in going back to your two reviews in The New Yorker this week, of the two films, I would have to say, based on your reviews, I think I'd rather see The Soloist.
Yeah, The Soloist, I have the feeling I'm going to like it more than other people, and that's a temptation to snark the soloist because it's about friendship and classical music and the redemptive power of music, and it's a kind of highfalutin idea in some way, but I thought it was done with considerable tough-mindedness.
Well, that was a relief because in the previews, I felt the same. I thought, no way.
Yeah.
This is going to be so overly sentimental.
Right. Well, it turns out it isn't.
So I'm going to see that. And
so
State
we'll
of
see
Play,
how the other critics deal with it. It's a very vulnerable movie, let's put it that way.
Oh, interesting.
It's going to be hard to build an audience for it. But this is Robert Downey again in this, and Jamie Foxx is a street musician in Los Angeles who was trained as a classical musician and suffers from schizophrenia and could not play regularly and is reduced to playing on the street. And Downey is a reporter for the Los Angeles Times. It's a love letter to the newspaper business also, both of these movies actually that you mentioned, and tries to help him. But he can only help him so far, and that's what I liked. I mean, it's tough-minded. It doesn't become really soppy. It doesn't say you can save another human being who's that far gone or that music will heal all the wounds that have been there for 20 years. That's why I say it's tough-minded.
That's an interesting genre of films, too, where somebody, I'm just making this up on the spot, but somebody educated and sensitive tries to save someone absolutely nuts who has a secret talent or something.
Right.
You know?
But the person who is the savior also needs saving. I mean,
oh, exactly, right.
That's the case here. I mean, and Downey is in his the character that is in his personal life is cut off in some ways, and this caring for this guy, even though there's only so much he can do for him, restores himself to a degree. So it's a kind of double act.
In fact, actually, going back to boxing briefly, a terrible version of that theme we're just inventing here was the one where there's a boxer living on the streets. It was recent. It was in the last couple of years.
Oh, I don't know. I'm not sure I saw that.
Oh, yeah. Well, you're probably fortunate that you didn't. But a rather famous actor, I think it's, I want to say, not Morgan Freeman. I'd get in trouble here if I just start imagining who it was.
We're going to have to figure out what this is.
We are going to have to figure it out.
Okay.
But before I let you go, because I don't want to keep you too long, we've been talking with David Denby, author of Snark. It's mean, it's personal, and it's ruining our conversation. And it's actually a fabulous book. David Denby is film writer for The New Yorker. And by the way, the cover of your book is one of the best designs I have seen.
Yeah, they did very well.
Ooh, it's fantastic.
The cover, there's a, the jacket has a kind of cutout hole in it. And then imprinted on the body of the hardcover itself, on the book cover, there is a snarling face. So it looks through this cutout window. It's as if someone's spying on us.
And the cover is bright yellow, so
this
if you see
yellow.
It at your bookstore. But I have one final question, if I may. Did I hear correctly that you might be putting together a book about film criticism, about trends?
Yes, I want to put together a collection of longer pieces. I don't think reviews, unless I can bunch some of them together, but I've done a number of longer essays over the years on the film business or on acting or different genre subjects. So, and I think I have to open them up and warm them up and bring them up to date a little bit, some of them, particularly anything that's about the film business. So that would be the next book.
Well, do you see any general trend that you're going to look into?
Well, the business is in rough shape at the moment, even though theatrical box office is good, but the mainstay in income, and this is still little known among the public perhaps, is not the theatrical box office. That can count for 20% or even less of the total revenue stream. It's DVD sales has been keeping this whole crazy system alive, you know, where you're spending $70 and $80 million on an ordinary, Kate Hudson comedy or something like that, or a little chase film. It's the pot at the end of the goal, the pot of gold at the end of the ancillary market, that is television, cable, and airline flights, and so on, the DVD sales. And that has fallen off enormously in the last year, and that's got everyone scared. So I think a lot of films are simply going to be canceled, because, and there's also less money sloshing into the system from the financial world.
Are these blockbusters making money, all this
crazy? Yeah, some of the ones that, and the reason they keep making them is that when they score big, they score really big, and if they're brought out by a conglomerate, it sells all the other things that the conglomerate does, too. It sells music, it sells toys, it sells video games. You know, so they become multi-use products, I think is the business jargon.
Right.
So, yes, that you will see a lot. You continue to see comic book movies that cost $150 million, you know, and that are essentially digital spectacle. There's a whole bunch of them coming up in the next 8 to 10 weeks, the summer movie season. And I don't have much hope for those. I don't find them very interesting for the most part. I did like, you know, the early Batman films very much. I thought were extremely inventive.
Yes.
The first two.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, what worries me is that the middle budget film is, which can't gross that kind of money and can't be used in that different way to sell other products, is going to drop out. And that may be, in other words, there'll be super low budget films for $2 million or even less. Believe it or not, people now with digital equipment, a bunch of kids can make a movie for $20,000 or $10,000. These are called mumblecore.
Oh, mumblecore. I read your piece about
that. Yes, mumblecore movies. And you essentially you fall out of bed and you start filming your friends. And, you know, I mean, there's a script, a vague script and an outline of sequences. And it's mainly about personal relations.
And aren't they mostly 20-something slackers?
They are slackers or they're, you know, more sort of partially employed, like a lot of kids now, because it's hard to crash the job market. So they've turned to filmmaking as a kind of, it is a kind of art movement. It's interesting. Anyway, that will persist, and the $1 million and $2 million movie will persist. But the movie that's in the middle there, that's $20 or $30 million, like Sideways or Brokeback Mountain, which I think is where most of the art is. I'm worried about that.
Oh, I see what you mean.
So it's going to polarize possibly to very small films and very large films. And a lot of the best writing and acting is in the middle there, and I'm worried about those continuing. So
the infinitely small and the huge.
And the huge.
It reminds me of one of the last sentences in one of my favorite films, The Incredible Shrinking Man.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, and there's good creative stuff in television, of course, where they're better able to keep costs down. I mean, there's stuff on HBO at a level that was, I think, would have been inconceivable in television 30 years ago.
Yeah.
So it's not, I mean, it's the energies are going in different directions that where it's more viable economically.
Things are shifting.
I like going to a theater, though. I like sitting with a group of strangers in the dark and being, as I said before, engulfed by the screen. I mean,
there's nothing like
a religious experience.
There's nothing like that, as long as they're not texting, wearing cheap cologne, and talking.
Yeah, you see this little glow of
I hate
open
the glow.
Cell phones all around you.
I hate the glow. The glow is just symptomatic of everything. The glow is bad.
Right. And you want the concentration of darkness.
I'm so angry at those people when the glow happens.
Yeah.
I sneer at them, but they can't see me because it's dark.
That's right.
So my sneer is useless. David, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much. My pleasure, too.
Thank you so much again for talking with us. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.